It's living hell.
This is what real hope looks like. This is the word that those hopeless people need to hear. This is the word that 3,000 people that try to commit suicide today, the 3,000 that will try to commit tomorrow, 3,000 that will try to commit on Monday, this is the word that they need to hear, is that there is hope.
It's real superpower. It's hope. There's hope. It means hope.
Welcome to Victims and Villains. This is the show where we talk nerd, we talk hope, and we speak nothing else. I'm your host, Captain Nostalgia, and if you guys are hearing this, that means Krypton premieres tonight, and we're talking all things Superman, so please help me in welcoming creator behind the book One Lucky Bride and Pigeon of Destiny, Miss Julia Hutchinson. This week we are joined by musical guest Citizen of the World.
Well, hey everybody, how you doing?
How are you?
I'm doing well, Josh. It's a beautiful day outside. We have skipped the snowstorm that was expected today.
We have.
Mm-hmm.
And that's always a good thing, because I don't know about you, I loathe snow. I don't know why. I'm not a fan of snow.
Mm-hmm. It's always such a magical thing when you're a kid. You think, oh, yeah, snow day. But when you grow up and it starts falling, you think, oh, shoveling, driving through snow, yeah. Falling, slipping, all that stuff.
Exactly. Like most like kids, like when it came to snow days growing up in my neighborhood, it was always like, oh, snowman, snow forts. Mine was get out there and shovel.
Aww.
And I think that's one of the reasons I hate snow.
Yeah. Aww.
So.
Yeah.
But tell us a little bit about yourself as a creator. Tell us a little bit about the properties that you have under your belt right now.
Well, right now I'm doing mostly short stories and anthology comics. The biggest story that I have so far is a 40-pager called One Lucky Bride that was included in the Fresh Romance Volume 2 Romance Comics Anthology put out by Emmett Comics, which was released this past fall. I also do small independent comics, you know, and I did Pigeon of Destiny, which was sort of a experimental comic from my end. You know those choose-your-own-adventure novels that you might have read as a kid?
Absolutely.
Where the format is you read a couple pages of story, and you are the hero. You know, it's like talking about you are the captain on a spaceship or whatever. And then there comes to a juncture, and you get to pick. If you want to go out and fight the aliens, turn to page 8. If you want to stay in and do your taxes, turn to page 12. You know what I mean? So I tried to do that same thing in a comic format, and that is my Pigeon of Destiny.
So I want to stay on Pigeon of Destiny real quick, and we'll talk about One Lucky Bride here in a second. But the Pigeon of Destiny, growing up, like, I've made it no stranger to the listeners of the show that I am a huge Goosebumps fan. And I loved the Give Yourself Goosebumps, Choose Your Own Adventure kind of thing that they did following the original series in the late 90s and early 2000s. Mm-hmm. And so how long are these? Because I remember, like, you know, you have all these different, like, alternative routes that you can take for, you know, the adventure that you want to go on, or the story, the play out the way that you want. So what is the process of creating these stories and their alternative endings or their alternative things in comic book form?
Well, the first thing you want to do is make sure that all of your story possibilities go somewhere and have a certain ending. So you need to start before even drawing the pages. You need to essentially create a story map that maps out the various decisions and where they go. So what I did is I took a whole mess of index cards and I put very, very simple thumbnails on them and jotted down at the bottom of each thumbnail the the directive, like, you know, turn to the next page or turn to page 10. And I cleared a wall in my room and I stuck up all of these index cards. Then as I was developing the story, I could sort of stand back and think, okay, you know, this needs to, this little couple pages needs to loop back to here. And so I kind of, you know, was able to rearrange, pick up and rearrange these index cards. And once I had that, then I was able to take a snapshot of that and keep all those on my wall for reference as I was drawing the story. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it seems like that you are essentially kind of taking a starting point and kind of going, you know, one of maybe, you know, 3 to 5 different ways and saying, all right, well, you know, I want if you want the pigeon to go to the edge of the ledge, turn to the next page. Mm-hmm. If you want him to go and save the damsel in distress, turn to page 10. You know, so like, do you find yourself it's more of a challenge doing these? Because we've had a lot of creators on this show, and we've never, ever had a creator with a choose-your-own-adventure on it. So it's cool to kind of it's cool and refreshing to kind of have a creator that does that. Do you find that it's more work putting into these stories than it is, say, a different comic or an illustration?
It was definitely an experiment for me to do Pigeon of Destiny in this format. The main reason I wanted to do it was just to see how it would feel to make a story like this. You are writing multiple storylines, which is more than what you're doing for a straightforward comic story. In this particular case, I kept the stories very, very short. And the whole tome barely reaches 40 pages. There are 11 possible endings, but they're all very simple. And moreover to that, I kept things kind of silly. Like, I wanted the tone to be light and off the wall and goofy, with wild twists and turns to make you say, oh, what? You know, so it's a story that definitely doesn't take itself too seriously, which I think is easier than if you wanted to make a straightforward story that handled a topic more seriously. So in that sense, there was more planning work, but it was also, in some ways, more simpler.
11 different endings. I would have, like, maybe in, like, a comic format, would have thought, like, you know, 3 to 5, but 11. That is impressive. What is the time rate as far as, like, creative process on something like that?
Are you asking how long it took me from start to finish to make it?
Yes.
I worked straight on through and dedicated my entire days, my time to this project. So from start to finish, it was about a month and a half. In those days, I wanted to get it ready for FlameCon in New York City in August of last year. So I made it a priority. And the book is also, it's not color, it's all black and white. So that also kind of, you know, took less time to do.
So I want to jump in and talk about One Lucky Bride, because One Lucky Bride was actually how I got affiliated with you from New York Comic Con. We met last year doing the Fierce booth with Joshua, Howe, author of The Fierce Are Fading and The Fierce Will Fall.
That's right.
And there was something about, I remember picking up your business card, and even when we were sending out emails to follow up, there's something about the color palette of this book that is unique. And it's not, the color palette is, it's bright, it's refreshing, and it's, but it also at the same time, it also has that feeling of warmth and heartfelt, and which serves as a perfect platform for comedy. Now, it's not every day that we get to have comedic writers on here, but tell us a little bit about this story, because this is a story that I feel like is vastly different than Pigeon of Destiny.
Well, thanks for your kind words about the color palette, Josh. This story here, One Lucky Bride. It is, in fact, a retelling of a 1924 silent film called Seven Chances, starring Buster Keaton. It's a romantic comedy, and in the original, it is about a young man who is in a lot of financial trouble. He gets a letter stating that he has fallen into an inheritance and that he is going to inherit $7 million if he can get married by 7 p.m. on his 27th birthday. And guess what? Today is his 27th birthday. So he goes to a country club and he knows seven women. And so his buddy is like, oh, well, now you got seven chances. Eh? Hence the title. And the film, you know, of course, it's a romantic comedy, and it's a Buster Keaton, so it's a comedy. So it goes off the rails, and it culminates in Buster Keaton getting chased by a horde of angry brides. So I watched this film, and I started to think, gosh, wouldn't it be cool if... And I love how often creative endeavors, or just any mess you get yourself into, right, starts with that phrase. Wouldn't it be cool if, and then you go off imagining. And I was imagining translating this story that I loved into comic format. And then I went a little step further and I thought, gosh, we live in 2016 now, at the time that I had this idea. Wouldn't it be cool if, just for funsies, if it was a female protagonist also being chased by a crowd of brides? And so I thought, well, hey, why not? It's my adaptation. I can make the modifications as I see fit, so I'm going to go with it. And so the finished product, One Lucky Bride, very closely follows some plot points of Seven Chances, but then there are some key details that I modified and made my own. For example, the prize money is no longer $7 million, you know, because that was in 1924 money. I changed it to $700 million. And other things, like in the original version, his love interest, who he wants to marry, but, you know, due to a comedic misunderstanding, he doesn't get to it, which is what leads him to propose to a bunch of other women. She kind of stays at home, sort of like a damsel in distress type of figure. Whereas in my version, the love interest takes a more active role. There's still that comedic misunderstanding because, you know, hey, it's a rom-com. If they understood each other right away, it would be too easy, right? Mm-hmm. So, but after, you know, certain plot points shake out, the love interest takes a more active role in seeking out the main character, and then, you know, and then they're trying to resolve this horde of angry brides that is indeed still chasing them.
And the cover art does wonders to that, what you're just talking about, to the chase of Silver Sue. But man, I have never heard of anyone doing a homage to a silent film. Most of this generations doesn't understand what a silent film is or where cinema came from. And as a film aficionado, like, I have to say, I truly love the fact of the source material and the fact that you're bringing this concept into a modern audience.
Well, thank you. It is a bit of a niche market, silent films. Because a lot of the people who grew up with that stuff are, you know, no longer with us. But very slowly but surely, there is a new generation that discovers silent films, every generation, really. And it's always very rewarding when I am talking about my comic. Let's say, for example, in an artist alley or in a convention, every so often I get to connect with someone who sees that the source material is Buster Keaton, a great silent film comedian, and the look on their face is like, oh, Buster, you know, because it's such an obscure thing that's being brought into this new medium of comics. So it's always fun to connect with other silent film fans.
Yeah, and I love that, you know, we were able to bring you on and talk about that, because it is, and I never would have, like, looked at that, you know, thinking that it is, a tribute to Buster Keaton or, you know, that era. But that's so cool that it is. And if you guys like tributes, check out our video on YouTube for the upcoming Edgar Allan Poe Chronicles. We'll drop a review and a link to the Kickstarter campaign when it drops on March 26th. But if you guys are listening to this right now, we are talking all things in the world of The Death of Superman, which is turning 25 this year. So I want to jump in and talk about legacy, because it takes something special for a book to still be talked about after all these years. What is your experience, and why do you think that the death of Superman has been so celebrated after all these years?
Well, it certainly shook my world back in 1992 when it came out. In those days, I was in grade school, as were my brothers, and we got the story and ate it up right away, because it had been very highly publicized and very much talked up. So it was like the thing to read that summer, if I recall correctly. And so it was, I guess it contributed to part of my early experience with comics, these tales. And so I think it endures because it is such an earth-shaking thing to happen. You know, but previously everyone had assumed Superman to be completely impervious to all things. And so to have this death of Superman is very much, very much changes your perception of what the character can do, what he's capable, and his limitations, and really just brought a lot more attention to Superman story arcs to the public eye.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. And the time period, and we're going to talk about this a little bit later, but the time period that this was produced in, it was around a time where comics really were in kind of a dying medium almost.
Mm-hmm.
And because this is not, when you look at this era of comics in the early 90s, you know, DC is, I think, almost bordering on bankruptcy.
Mm-hmm.
And they, you know, it's a couple years after the Superman 4 Quest for Peace, that bankrupted the studio that produced it. So, you know, Superman was such this iconic character for so long, and he had fought in so many people that, you know, to kind of, it almost had been a joke around the DC office that they were going to kill Superman.
Right.
But this is also at a time period where you're talking about Bane broke Batman. So Bruce Wayne is no longer Batman at this time. It was either around this time or a couple years later that Diana Prince was no longer Wonder Woman. It was now Artemis. A couple years after that, it was Hepatia, her mother. So you're really the three big characters that DC was known for at that time. You have broken, dethroned, and beaten. Killed off of these three to make way for, you know, new story arcs. And I think when you're talking about the legacy of Superman, it was such a, like you had said, it's such a groundbreaking story that for us to really consider and really acknowledge the reason that it has been successful after all these years and talked about for so these years is because you literally killed the strongest character in that canon.
Right.
And that had not been done at that before. And it really, I don't think, has been done since.
Right. Yeah, that's all true, definitely. And it certainly brought a lot of attention to the medium of comics, specifically the superhero genre as well. I understand that there was a lot of a lot of non-comics folks were starting to turn and notice the Superman Doomsday story arc specifically. And it got a lot of press, you know, a lot of talking about in the newspapers and on television that this is going down this monumental story arc of the death of Superman. And indeed, a lot of people outside of the comics community understood it to be a final thing. So that also got people's attention, you know, their expectation that Superman was going to be dead for good.
Yeah, and I mean, Superman's like one of the most beloved characters of all time. And when you're talking about symbols from American culture, the Superman emblem is one of the most recognized symbols from around the world.
Yeah.
And that and Batman both are, you know, synonymous with, you know, the cross. A lot of people know that. A lot of people know the American flag. Like, these are symbols that if you showed someone in India or Africa or England, they would know and they would recognize that, you know, this is a world-renowned character. And not only the legacy of this at, you know, standing tall after 25 years later, but also you had talked about the fact that it was getting people that weren't normally comic readers interested in this. And DC a couple of years ago, or Warner Brothers more or less, put out a great documentary that is super hard to find, but it's, if you can get your hands on it, it's a fantastic documentary. It's called Secret Origins, The History of DC Comics. And they were talking about when this first went into production and the backlash. Superman only came back because of the backlash of this. You know, you had people legitimately like rioting and writing in DC and why would bring back Superman, like,
yeah,
like this character, you never really know how much a character's impact is until you take them out of the public spotlight. And I think that Death of Superman is such a great example of that impact and that authority that Superman really carries with him.
Indeed, I understand that there was a full-on hiatus of all the Superman titles for about 3 months after the death of Superman, or after the funeral bit was done. Then all of the titles went on hiatus. Something else I wanted to mention about the trade paperback itself, because when I heard that we were going to be talking Superman, Josh, I ran over to one of the local comics stores in Brooklyn, and I got me a copy of Death of Superman. It's funny because when I went into the shop, I told the guy what I was looking for, and he said, ah, and he led me right over there. He told me that, in his own opinion, Death of Superman ranks right up there with other graphic novels that are on the must-read list, such as Mouse and Persepolis. So that kind of made me read the story with a little bit more of a mind to that, like, would I rank it up there? And I have to say that in the technical realm, I really do appreciate it for its aesthetics. You see, this particular trade paperback, it is, I think, 7 issues collected. And the last 4 do something very interesting that I only noticed after, like, the second or the third read-through. Where the 4th-to-last issue is done only with 4 panels, whereas previously there was, like, you know, a 6-panel layout or, you know, varying layouts. But the 4th-to-last one is only 4 panels. The 3rd-to-last issue, and in this issue, Superman has already engaged Doomsday and they're fighting it out and stuff, and he's leaving a path of destruction. But 3rd-to-last issue, only 3 panels, and it goes on. 2nd-to-last issue, only 2 panels, and then the final issue, which is Superman and Doomsday in Metropolis. It's a knockdown, drag-out fight between the two of them. They're both getting beaten up terribly, and it is nothing but single-page panels all the way through. And each one looks like a comic book cover. And at that point, reading it, was so engaged in the story, I didn't even notice that was going on. The panel format, you know, was changing with every issue. Only until, like, I was halfway through the very last issue, where Superman's giving it his all, and his cape is ripped off, and, you know, parts of his outfit are missing, he's bleeding, and Doomsday there. Only then do I realize, hey, whoa, the format has changed, you know? Oh, and so I kind of like flipped back and I was like, oh, that's really cool. I thought that was a really neat aesthetic choice that the artist and writer chose to do. I really appreciate that.
And, you know, you talk about that. The art style of this is, like you said, yeah, it really does start counting down and does that. The 4 and the 3 and the 2 mm-hmm. and the 1. Mm-hmm. I think, and that's another reason why it stands out, and the reason why it has stood the test of time for all these years is because that's a part of the legacy. You know, when you're talking a couple months ago, we had our friends over at Superliminal Films, over on our show, and we were talking about Watchmen.
Ah.
And Watchmen is the same exact way for the majority of its book. It's all 9 panels.
They're crazy 9. Yep. They're 9 panel structure. Yeah.
And there's so few books that do that where you can pick it up and it survived that legacy. Even with Doomsday Clock now, it's still serving homage and doing that 9 panel structure. And so when you're picking up comics, you're not going to pick up 9 times out of 10, you're not picking up comics that have structure to the art style like The Death of Superman or like Watchmen or Doomsday Clock. It's very scattered and it's very much whatever that page needs to be. But I think that art style makes it very distinct. And when you're talking about a industry that really doesn't focus on specifics, when you're making it that way, you know, your art that way, it helps you stand out and really be an individual at that point as well.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. It's subtle, but it's very important detail, I think. And it's something that you can only do in the medium of comics, isn't it? You couldn't have this sort of pacing set up with something such as a film or a written prose. You can only do it with comics. And I think it's something worthwhile as a creator to make note of this and to use it, use the specific tools of this medium to tell a story and affect your readers, even though it is, like I said, I didn't even notice it until the second or third read-through, but it still had an effect on me. The way the panels in their structure kind of have create a tension, isn't it? Especially that countdown. Tension to the final climax of the two of them fighting. So it's really nice to look at it from a creator standpoint to see what the thought process of this creative team was doing. And to take that into your own practice is good to see.
Yeah, so you know, we're talking about the countdown and the build up between the two, you know, Big Blue and the Big Ugly.
That's right.
I'm just going to kind of jump in. I think the one thing that this story does extremely well is the build-up and the anticipation of Doomsday, because when you're reading it, the first issue that kicks it off is Man of Steel number 18,
mm-hmm.
and it says, somewhere else, Doomsday is coming.
Yeah.
Unrelentingly, Doomsday is coming. Unstoppably, Doomsday is coming.
Yeah.
Unbelievably, Doomsday is here. And so you just kind of... And it's, you don't see anything about this character. You just see fists and the force that this creature has.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that that's a really compelling factor because, you know, we've had Superman. We've seen Superman go up against, you know, Brainiac, Lobo, Mr. Mixoplex, Lex Luthor, mm-hmm. all of these other characters. But nothing that has really, you know, given him a run for his money the way that Doomsday had.
Mm-hmm. And I love that you brought up this opening sequence. I've got my my copy open here on my lap, and I'm paging through it as you're talking about it. And I love the way that they chose to hold back the true image of Doomsday to create, once again, that anticipation and that tension of just who is this character who is, you know, about to go head to head with Superman. And they do that very deliberately, I think, to gain audience interest, to, like I said, build up anticipation, and to kind of encourage you to follow along and see what's going to happen. Unfortunately, that start of the story, almost, when I first read it as a 7-year-old, almost made me shut the book forever and put it under the bed. You want to know why?
Of course.
Because when Doomsday punches through his metal prison and comes out, he happens upon a very beautiful pastoral wilderness. There's trees swaying, there's grass, there's birds cheeping, and there's one moment that to this day I'll never forget. He extends his hand, and at this point he's still wrapped up in his prisoner's outfit. He's just like clothed in green with these two red goggle eyes. He's got one arm tied behind his back, right? So we know nothing about him at this point. He extends one hand out, and a little yellow canary flies onto his hand, cheeping. Do you remember this part?
Yeah, I'm actually turning there right
now. Oh my goodness. He extends his hand, the bird flies down and looks up at him, trusting, sweetly, goes, cheep. But then the next panel, he crushes his fist, and the bird's in it, and you can see, peeking out his fist, the little open-beaked head of the little bird. And you can hear inside your own head reading it, you can hear the cries of the little bird. And that affected me more than anything when I read it, because it was very shocking, very unexpected. And I'm a bird lover, Josh, if you can't tell from my work. So, you know, really, really hurtful for me to see. And then, of course, in the bottom panel, you see he goes, ha, 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 you know. Because that's who he is. And that's like just about the first bit of information that you get about Doomsday. He does the same thing with a deer later. He's still out in the wilderness and a deer approaches him and he grabs it by the throat, I believe. And yeah, anyway, just those little details that stick with you, isn't it? Little comic moments.
Yeah, and I love the introduction of, because the end of the first issue, you have this looks like a job for the Justice League.
Yeah,
so
you're
introducing the Justice League America, which again, talking culture, we'll talk here in about a few minutes. But there's a scene where the two of the Justice League members, Bloodwind and Maxima, actually are serving as telepaths, and so they can reach this creature via telepathy, mm-hmm. and just try to reach out or like locate him. And Maxima says, quote, I found the creature. He's hate, death and bloodlust personified,
mm-hmm.
nothing more.
Right.
And this comes back towards the end of the issue with, or towards the end of the story arc with the Guardian and his telepathy friend character. And, you know, that's just those little bit moments of, as you're discovering who this villain is, you know, death and bloodlust personified. Like, that is just something that, you know, we haven't seen up to this point in comics before. You know, just someone that doesn't have an agenda just wanted to watch the world burn, truly.
Yeah. Yeah. Apparently, no motive. No thought on his mind but destruction, and with a single-minded purpose to make a straight line, destroying everything in his path, be it street or house or mall or anything, just one straight line heading to Metropolis, which is pretty scary. Yeah.
And And that's something that they talk about throughout the course of it. You know, as every time that, because there are a couple of moments where Superman loses track of Doomsday, and he does it for, you know, noble reasons. Like, there's a scene where you are having to save a mother and a son from a burning building.
Right.
So he goes and does that. He does the whole hero thing. But, you know, when he's talking about trying to find the antagonist again, he's just said, I just follow the path of destruction, because literally everything that is this character is doing is just destroying everything in his path.
Right. They've got news anchors and choppers on the scene as well. And the entire story is kind of, you know, the news team kind of follows the action, and they're reporting from the air, and they're saying, oh, it's looking, he looks like he's leaving the same amount of destruction as a tornado. So the amount of damage he's doing looks like a tornado going through town. And, you know, they say tornadoes, I've never been in one, but they say that they kind of leave like one line of destruction that can go through. So that's kind of an interesting visual to have for that. Yeah. Indeed. Yeah. I have not actually seen Batman vs. Superman. I'm kind of behind on my film watching. So that is actually news to me that Doomsday makes an appearance, but I think that is pretty cool that he shows up. Yeah. I love his design. I love that they, going back to the trade, I love that they hid his true form at the start and the beginning issues, and very slowly his outfit comes off, and revealing those bony protrusions, the gray skin, and the terrible eye, and what you're going to call it, the beard made out of bone, if you will.
I think it does pay off, and sometimes in comics it's not always the best thing to do, but when you're introducing a character like Doomsday, I love the way that he's written and he's handled in this that, you know, oh, let's do the Justice League. And it serves, it slowly sets up the building for this grand finale.
Mm-hmm. It's true. When you withhold information about a certain character, that's what makes it all the more mysterious and all the more memorable, I think. Because if you don't know what he wants, if you don't know what he's there for, if he hardly even speaks a word except for his grumbling, his Metropolis, that you can totally hear in your head when you read it, he's just that much more creepy and that much more scary and effective as a villain. You know what I mean?
Ladies and gentlemen, we will be right back right after a brief break. But this is Citizen of the World, and this song is called In the Moment.
I was in the moment, talked in your eyes. I was in the moment, you lost your mind. I was in the moment, you gave up. I was in the moment, that I picked you up.
And I'm Alex.
And we have a question for you.
Do you think you're crazy?
You know, Alex, I don't think they do. I mean, does anyone?
You're right, Megan. Well, I'm here to tell you, those weird little quirks and tics probably seem normal to you.
But you're not normal. You're crazy.
The question is, just how crazy are you?
And we're here to tell you that.
We're the hosts of the Crazy Clinic Podcast. The podcast where we take your most uncanny habits, bizarre pet peeves, outlandish thoughts, unconventional fears, and dive deep into the background and psychology of chosen topics to inform you just how crazy you really are.
Join us Monday on SoundCloud, Apple Products, and pretty much anywhere podcasts can be heard to find out how crazy you
and everyone else
really are.
All right, welcome back to Victims and Villains. I am still here with Julia Hutchinson, and we are talking all about the death of Superman still. But I want to talk about this piece real quick, because when I first read this book, I had really never been as fluent in the language and comics mythology as I am now. So, like, reading it this past time in preparation for this episode, I noticed a lot more things. And what I noticed was that this is definitely a culture timepiece of the 90s where this took place. And I say that this is a story that has a platform for lesser known characters. I don't think that you could go to a convention and immediately start a conversation with something like The Guardian or the World War Worlders, Fire, Ice, Green Lantern lists, Guy Gardner, Bloodwinds, and Maxima. And I think that that's a fascinating piece to have, that you wouldn't have the death of this icon be surrounded by characters that he's most associated with Green Lantern, Batman and Wonder Woman and, you know, Aquaman. So the platform that for lesser known characters on this, what did you take away with reading this, with kind of interacting with some of these characters?
Well, I definitely saw the tie-ins with various other characters. I personally am not too familiar with the Justice League of America. After having read this book, it inspired me to go out to my local library and to pull a few other titles related to the two. So I got me a copy of Justice League America and Superman. It's volume one, and it is originally published in 1992. And so it's just a pre-Doomsday adventures with the Justice League and the way that they interact with each other and the way the team dynamics are. In this particular volume, they had just been broken up and a new villain causes them to reform, you know, bigger and better than ever. So the way that Death of Superman has endured has kind of maybe given a second life to these secondary characters, inviting you to go back and research their stories and, you know, see these comics with more historical look to them.
Yeah, and I totally agree. And I had walked away with kind of like, you know what, I kind of want to, because I want to know more about these characters, because at this time, for years, I've been, you know, saying that I'm not a fan too much of the comics that come from the 90s with, you know, the select few stories, the death of Superman and Infinity Gauntlet. Mm-hmm. But there are so many, like, but I'm slowly starting to change my mind about that because I'm now reading and investing into these stories. And when you're having characters, I think it's an interesting dynamic that you have a Justice League that's made up of all these, you know, so to say, B-level characters, because when you talk to people, most mainstream audiences, about the Justice League, they're going to tell you that, oh, Batman, Superman,
right,
Wonder Woman,
right,
Aquaman, Cyborg, yeah, The Flash, because Green Lantern, these are all the, you know, for the last 7 years with the New 52, that's the continuity that, you know, most people are familiar with, and having the film this past November doesn't really kind of also hammers that home, because, you know, that's just what we've grown familiar with. But at this time that this story took place, Batman was broken. Wonder Woman went off and did, I stand corrected, I think that the three big leaders of this, they went off and did Justice League sectors. So you had Superman led Justice League America. Then you had Wonder Woman doing Justice League of Europe. Then you had Batman doing, I think, Justice League International or like Justice League Canada or something along those lines. But these three big DC-based characters, they all went off and took the idea of Justice League, but they did it around the world, essentially. And that's a that's a thing to understand about that this wasn't a story that took place outside of, you know, some continuity. It very much took place, and it's very much a time capsule and a culture piece of the 90s and the time that it took place.
It's definitely a snapshot into another place and another time. And when you look at it, you do have to keep that in mind. Yes, these characters are not the ones that are headlining big movies today, but are significant in their own right and you know, had been developed and that you can still connect with when you go back to read, you know, these older comics. It definitely for younger readers who are more accustomed to today's modern comics, it takes a little bit of getting used to, specifically certain stylistic elements such as the art and some of the dialogue. You can read it and you're like, oh, okay, that's pretty 90s. You know, you do come across a little bit of catchphrases that they say and certain attitudes you wouldn't see normally in comics today that you see here as well. So it does take a little bit of getting used to getting back into it.
Absolutely. And the language I found is cleaner in this one. There's a scene in particular where Guy Gardner is being carried off into a gurney, and he turns to Superman and says, you know, if you don't kick this guy's butt, I'm going to come back and kick both of your butts.
Yeah.
And the language like that just wouldn't exist in today's culture or comics, because we're not afraid to drop a few cuss words in, you know, these mainstream titles like Justice League or X-Men or Avengers or Batman or Superman or Action Comics. We're not afraid to do that anymore. And, you know, this is a simpler time. This is a cleaner time where, you know, what came out of this story with, you know, the reign of the Superman,
mm-hmm.
and Superboy, and even the character design of Superboy is very much 90s, and it's very much a time capsule for these times. And even you talked about character design. When I first read this, because I had read it in so long, the Bloodwind character looks very much like Sam Wilson of the Falcon from Marvel.
Oh yeah,
I was like, what is he doing in this story?
Yeah, that's true.
And so when I saw that, I, you know, when they first announced him that it was this guy named Bloodwind, I was like, cool.
Yeah, there's definitely a bit of an innocence to it in the language, as you say, and also reflected in simply the colors that comics today have got a little bit more of a darker color to them. And I realize that a big portion of that is the technical limitations of that era, but it's still good. Something else I like to notice and point out from this trade is the way that the pacing works. There's a lot of action because it's, you know, the main push of the story of Superman fighting Doomsday, but it's not just explosions and buildings cracking and people getting thrown through windows. There's also quiet moments that occur in the course of this trade where the focus is more on smaller characters or smaller stories. Right at the beginning, it picks up from a young boy named Keith who is purchasing glow-in-the-dark spray paint. And his plan is that his mother, he believes, is being held captive by a series of villains who live underground, underworlders, I believe they're called. And his entire world is that he needs to get his mother back. So he runs, you know, underground and is seeking her. And it touches upon the Superman story because Lois Lane gets involved. And finally, in the end, things get too big for Keith to handle. And he goes above ground and he takes his spray paint and spray paints a giant S emblem in a basketball courtyard. And that's what brings Superman down to him. But he has a quiet moment where, you know, he sees Superman and he hugs him. And, you know, they have a little bit of a talk there. But so little stories like that get interspersed with the action that I think makes for a really effective pacing strategy, and also keeps you, you know, keeps the volume level varied. When I say volume, I'm talking about big action being high volume and quieter moments. You know what I mean? Like, it keeps that variety that makes you want to continue reading.
Yeah, I get that. And I think that even with the storyline, it also introducing between, you know, this kid, I think his name was Max.
The teenager, Mitch, with the long blonde hair and the turned, the kid is so 90s. He's got a ball cap turned backwards. He's on a skateboard. He's got his bubble gum. Yeah.
The grunge era.
The grunge.
That's very much what that kid is. But, you know, these smaller storylines of, you know, Superman rescuing, or the Justice League, you know, rescuing, they're very much, it keeps it grounded, and it keeps you, you know, it also showcases who this character are and who these characters are, that at their heart, that they're heroes, that they'll do anything for the common good, to really stop forces like Darkseid, Doomsday.
Right.
Wrong story. But, you know, these, and I love those quieter moments like you're talking about. Those are some of the best moments in here, especially with Keith. I feel like his, like, short little arc that he has in the first issue, it reminds you of why we love Superman, and it reminds you of Superman's heart to, you know, for the little guy. And I feel like that is put on display so well in the first couple of issues before it, you know, it builds and shifts to really Superman versus Doomsday.
Right. Towards the end of it, it's primarily the big fight, the thing that you came for, you know, the knockdown, drag out fight.
Yeah. And I mean, we're a show that, you know, while we do talk about nerd and while we do talk about pop culture, we also talk about mental health. And so what we've been trying to do with every comic or television show or, you know, covered, you know, subject that we're covering, we have been trying to engage and pull something out about mental health, or, you know, something out about that we believe that we could give it a mental health spin. And there's a scene in here where the Justice League of America, because Justice League, you know, America, it just sounds weird. There's a scene after Superman leaves, and it's a quiet scene after, you know, showcasing the aftermath of Doomsday's destruction. And Maxima, Ice, and Blue Beetle are all... Blue Beetle's unconscious. He's currently in a coma. And Maxima has the power to really, you know, save his life. And she's arguing Ice with this, you know, point back and forth. Well, that's not really in my, you know, DNA. You know, I'm a warrior. I'm bred. And she's like, she's pleading with her. She's like, would you just stop and, you know, save his life? And I think that sometimes, and I want to talk about this, because I feel like sometimes in our day-to-day lives is that one conversation that we could have, or like one moment to stop, you know, our lives, really your words or your actions really have the power to change someone's life and alter the course of their depression, or alter the course of their suicidal tendencies, or their self-harm, or their addictive nature. So jumping in, you know, that's a perfect application and perfect lesson that we can walk away with the death of Superman, you know, doing the right thing, and really what that looks like, and how 5 seconds of kindness can really change someone's life forever.
It's true. It's a small moment here, but Maxima is definitely perfectly prepared to let the character die. I've forgotten his name. The
Blue Beetle,
right.
Ted Kord.
Perfectly, you know, prepared to just say, well, you know, his time is done. I need to keep on fighting. But I am glad that they do take 1 second to step aside from that and allow for something more human, that she does indeed choose to get up and go. And, you know, going off of that idea of, you know, mental health and going through struggles, I do kind of notice how during the course of this story, Superman, he's never alone. He's got always people who are there trying to help him fight, cheering him on. Even at the very end, he's got people who are witnessing it and just supporting him in what he's doing and trying their best to help, even though it's looking, well, you know, towards the end, it's looking pretty bad. He's never alone. He's always got people who are there for him.
Yeah, and I think that when you can surround yourself with people that in your life, I think that that's so crucial from, you know, kind of walking away from depression and walking away from suicide, is that it has to start with one conversation, and that one conversation or that chance to really surround yourself with those individuals that can be a good influence on you to really get the help that you need is crucial. And I love the fact that you mentioned that Superman's never alone throughout the course of the story. Like, I mean, granted, like towards the end of the story, like he's kind of alone, but you know, he still has people that are cheering for him, still have people that are, you know, really worried about him. And I feel like that makes such an interesting dynamic, and there's such a sense of hope that even when Superman is, you know, on the edge of death, and spoiler alert, he dies in the end.
No. The title, like,
yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I feel like even in that way, that regard, you know, there's still some hope that, you know, even though Lois has now lost her husband, she still has Jimmy, she still has Martha Kent, that, you know, we saw in Justice League. That was a great example. Even when you're losing someone that you love, you still have a support system that's built in that around that. And I feel like support systems and having people in your life, it's so crucial. You know, whatever you're doing, and whether you're hopeful or you're hopeless, you need to have those people in your life that you can bounce off of, and people that can be in your corner to cheer for you.
It's the pure truth right there, Josh. You never, in your life, you never truly know what you do for others just by your own presence, just by being there. It makes me think about, you know, the little ways that you touch people's lives where you might not think about it or might not realize it. Even something small like the people that you interact with day to day that are not your friends or family, just like, you know, the other people in your life. And by your being there can bring a little bit of, you know, light into their life, or vice versa. And the way that you need to, I mean, sometimes we just have to trust in those connections, don't we? Especially when you're thinking, oh, you know, what do I bring to the table? What do I bring? What can I possibly bring? You know, you gotta, don't sell yourself short, you know, gotta give yourself more credit than that for your being there does add something. And indeed you are there for a reason, though it might not be perfectly apparent right at the moment, that you do have something to contribute by your being there. It's something that it's very, very human to hear that message and to immediately come with a million counter arguments right in your own head. You know, even for our readers, for our listeners who might be listening right now, you might be like countering those words, like, oh, well, you know, it sounds nice to say that. And maybe that's true for other people, but for me, I've done this and this and this, or I've said this thing, you know, that was bad or wrong, and all those reasons that you come up with to convince yourself that somehow you are less than. And it's not true. It's it's the greatest challenge to stand up to those thoughts inside your own head and say, you know, okay, maybe I'm not perfect, but then again, I'm still allowed to be here, aren't I? And I'm still allowed to do, and I'm still allowed to grow and overcome. And that's the challenge. That's about the hardest thing.
And I love that you took the words right out of my mouth. It is the hardest thing. And you know, the reason we put out the content that we put out is so that you guys can know that truth, so that you guys don't have to, you know, feel like you are alone. That's the reason we publish this. That's the reason we do, you know, YouTube, and we're getting ready to launch another channel. That's the reason why we put out PS Midnight Cast and Reborn and Remembered, and we're working on comics right now, is so that you guys can know your value, your worth, and, you know that you don't have to be alone. Even if you feel alone, there are still people around you that love you. And I think that, you know, Superman going head-to-head with Doomsday is a great example for, you know, mental health.
Mm-hmm.
It's a great allegory that, you know, depression or anxiety or, you know, suicidal tendencies or addiction or self-harm or self-loathing, all of these things, all of that move within us are very much so that we can, you know, they're the hardest battles to do,
mm-hmm.
battle every day. And now I'm saying that from someone who has battled depression, who has battled anger, who has battled anxiety, addiction, you know, even suicidal thoughts, that it is one of the biggest things to fight in your life. And every day is a new day. Every day is something fresh and something pure and something original that you can hold in the palm of your hands. And that thing is called hope. Hope for every day and those connections too.
Mm-hmm. Indeed. So what do you think, Josh? Do you think that Doomsday could be read as a metaphor or an allegory for some manner of internal conflict or strife, a depression or anxiety or something of that nature?
Oh, absolutely. I think that when you're talking about, you know, the size of Doomsday and there's a lot of panels that are a lot of characters in this arc that comment on his size.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, they mentioned towards the end of the, you know, well, Superman's not even going to stand up to him. I feel like, you know, we are as strong as we allow ourselves to be.
Mm-hmm.
And we're as strong as the people that we surround ourselves with. And Doomsday very much is an allegory for that because of, you know, how big and how monstrous
and how apparently unstoppable he is.
Yes.
Indeed, many characters say, oh, these laser cannons do not faze him. Bullets, everything. He just keeps on going. Well, of course, Superman also keeps on going. Particularly, what gives Superman strength is especially when Doomsday gets near those that he loves, when it comes to the head in Metropolis and Lois is right there and his friends are right there, and Doomsday is on the verge of harming his loved ones, is when he gets the most strength to fight back harder than ever.
Yeah, and I couldn't agree more that, you know, there are a lot of things that faze you, but you opening up a conversation or reaching out for hope and reaching out for help makes you as strong as Superman. And in the end, Doomsday falls and Superman lives just a little bit longer. But the plus side of Superman, like we talked about earlier, there was a discontinuation in the Superman, Supergirl, and Action Comics and all of those titles for 3 months.
Mm-hmm.
But eventually, Superman returns, and Superman is back,
right?
And resurrected. And that's a great thing to really consider as well, is that when you have the power and you have the authority to really put depression or anxiety or whatever your insert problem here is, the thing that's holding you back from the lies that, that are being spoken over you, that is the perfect jumping off point to really fight back and know that those issues and those problems, they can be dead and that they should be dead.
Indeed so, Josh. The ultimate victory was Superman's, and it is not a stretch to imagine that struggles that people might face on the day-to-day, while not being as dramatic as played out here in the comic pages, are no less significant, you know, in your own struggles, your own inner demons, so to speak, that you fight against. Mm-hmm.
That's a great point. And so if you're listening to this right now and you or someone you know is struggling with suicide, addiction, self-harm, or depression, please reach out. Suicide right now in our own country is the 10th leading cause of death. There are 123 suicides that occur each and every day. And for every successful one of those suicides, 25 more are being attempted. That's 3,075 suicides attempted. Mm. And that's one death roughly every 12 minutes right here in the United States. But when you're talking internationally, there's one death roughly every 40 seconds. So please reach out. You guys can reach out to us on any of our social media. We'll have links in the descriptions below, as well as the Suicide Lifeline. It's 1-800-273-8255. Or also you can text anonymously to 741-741. But there are conversations go so long. They go so much further than you can ever imagine. So open up and talk to someone. We highly encourage it. Be the Superman of the situation, not the doomsday.
Well said. I like that. Yeah.
Thank you. What are future projects that you got going on right now, and where can people find you online?
Well, you can find me online on my website, juliahutt.com. I like to tell people so they can remember, I say, it's not the Pizza Hut, it's the Julia Hut. Eh? Eh? Anyway, nice. And I'm on Twitter at Julia_the_Hutt. So like Julia the Hutt. My next project is going to be another romantic comedy. This one is going to be taken from a page of the Hallmark Christmas movie specials that you often see on the Hallmark Channel. But the twist is that it is going to be with two women who are in love. So once again, it takes all of those tropes that you see. And if you've seen those Hallmark films, they're very formulaic, you know, the beats are very consistent and it's all very kind of sappy and just kind of make you feel good. But my friend and I noticed that, you know, these stories are all with heterosexual couples. Where's the representation for homosexual couples? Why can't they also have their sweet, sappy, Christmassy love story? So this next story is written with a friend of mine who is a big Hallmark movie aficionado. And they're writing it, and I'm drawing it, and it's going to be, once again, just a very sweet story with a happy ending, just as though it were a Hallmark movie, but it's comic form and it's gay.
Nice. We'll have all the links in the descriptions below for Julia. And like we say every time, like, follow, and subscribe to us on all our social media platforms. Again, links in the descriptions below for more hope-filled content. And if you guys caught Krypton, what did you guys think about it and why? Also, if you guys have read The Death of Superman, why do you think that it has survived so long? That is going to do it for us this week, but we are leaving you guys this week. Once again, this is Citizen of the World. This song is called Free to Go. And until next time, remember, keep talking nerd, talking hope, and speaking nothing else.
You're free to go now. Stay another day. My life's on hold now. My head spins fast, my body drenched, cold sweat. spinning, swirl an ugly mess. Good times would come by, hey. At least that's one of the lies we told. You don't hope, you don't feel, you don't pray.